tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan.
This week I have two guests. My first guest is Gilbert Mercier. Gilbert is one of the editors of the newsjunkiepost.com, and he's an author, and he recently published a book called The Orwellian Empire, and I will be chatting with Gilbert about how prophetic that book was, that George 1984 that George Orwell wrote. And then stay tuned right after Gilbert, because we'll be speaking to my friend Dylan Avery about one of the re-releases of his film about 9/11 called Loose Change. So stay tuned, and I'll be back with Gilbert Mercier and Dylan Avery.
Gilbert Mercier, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really a great pleasure to join you on your soapbox, for you to make some room for me on your soapbox, because I've been following your work for many, many years during the Bush administration, and you've done some terrific work.
And also, I haven't stopped, even though Obama's president, because the crimes of the U.S. empire, unfortunately, haven't stopped at all.
They actually have, in many, many ways, they got worse during the presidency of now what is a lame duck president. You see, one of the points I'm trying to make in my new book, The Orwellian Empire, is that this country, in the past 3 decades, hasn't changed much at all. It's been the same people in power from one administration to another ever since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. And it's been run by other people. It's been run by Bush Sr., who, by the way, before his position as VP for Ronald Reagan, was running the CIA. And it's been run by Clinton afterwards, for a brief time, bringing another group of people that are not exactly recommendable. Bush Jr., as everybody know, but of course Obama was a continuation of Clinton, because Obama got, well, he had to use Clinton's folks, you see. So it's sort of, there's been for 3 decades always power behind the official powers and advisors, and struggle between different ideologues and lies, an incredible amount of lies.
Well, before we get too more deeply into the very substance of the interview, which is your new book, The Orwellian Empire, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and about your background. Obviously, you're French, and so before we end this interview, I'd like to chat a little bit about what's going on in France right now, get your take on it. But tell my listeners about a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I started working in the press, in the radio business when I was very, very young. I was still living in France, and I had my own show. And then I decided to move to the U.S. and it's actually, I mentioned that in my book. I I think it was in 1981 when the first McDonald's restaurant opened in Paris. And to me, it was really a wake-up call. I realized that my culture, you know, who happens to be French culture, was getting invaded by some corporate culture, subculture coming from the U.S. So my first wife, you know, is American, and we met in Paris, and we decided, well, she was not exactly pro that move, but to move to the U.S., which we did, and for a while, for a certain amount of time, I used to work in the film business, in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, I did pretty well, and I used to own a house in New Orleans. And to me, well, of course, 9/11 was a wake-up call, a very, very big wake-up call, but New Orleans was really what triggered me to go back to my passion, which is news, which is journalism, photojournalism, and writing about non-fictional stuff. This is kind of my trajectory here, if you wish, and that's sort of when I started to realize that I was the first to mention it publicly, the notion of disaster capitalism that was in full display in New Orleans post Katrina, and the way this country that has become my home, because I moved to the U.S. in 1983, was not the same country that I first saw when I came here in the late 1970s. It was a different place, and it became less democratic. It became, things changed.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a good way.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, and you were first here in the 70s, and then in the 90s, and the actually, you know, obviously the 2010 is a much different country than, you know, I was born here in 1957, so we can talk about, you know, how much different it is now than then. But you wrote an article for Thanksgiving about, you know, just the same thing, that maybe this is becoming different for, you know, white Americans and things like that. But this country was founded on slavery and indigenous genocide. So it's not like we were, you know, an innocent, pure country until the 70s, right?
Well, there were some good period. You know, you cannot contest that somebody like FDR did some good thing in terms of social program, for example, and even corporation like Henry Ford, which was in many aspect of his life and what he did, sort of a despicable human being, but mm-hmm. at least at the time where the car industry flourished in the U.S., anybody that worked for Ford that built a car could actually buy one. They could, an American family could support itself on one income. You see, so it was never capitalism. It is never a good thing. It never works for the little people. It's a way to concentrate assets in a very few hands. But at some point, Detroit was the crown of the automotive industry worldwide. And now Detroit is a no man's land. Detroit
exactly.
has been gutted. And this is not only Detroit. I travel a lot in the U.S. I go everywhere. You can see it. You can see it anywhere. You can see the desolation of of the result of what I have called originally, and I repeat, in 2005, disaster capitalism. You know, it is just not, it doesn't serve the interest of the American people. It doesn't serve, it serves the interest of corporations. You know, it's sort of what the U.S. has turned into is a corporate plutocracy, who in many sense is supported by the war profiteering, and that's one of the reasons why the Orwellian Empire like its war to never end. The war in Afghanistan is not ending. The war in Iraq is not ending. The war in Syria, well, it's not ending at all. The war in Yemen is just getting started. And it is endless. It's just bad policy, not only for Americans, but for everyone else in the world. You know, since 1945, just to give an idea to your listeners, the 70 years ago, okay, the U.S. military has never left from Germany, never left from Japan, never left from North Korea since the 50s. They never left from Italy. They never left from the U.K. There's 10,000 U.S. military troop in the U.K. Now, who is the occupier now? Can you hear me, Cindy?
Gilbert? Hi.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I had my mic muted because I don't want interference. I forgot to unmute it. But when you call it the Orwellian Empire, and you know, many people who have studied George Orwell's 1984, we see so many parallels between what's happening today with the police state, the rise of corporate fascism, as you've said, and we see especially in these continuous wars where the enemy of Oceania was always changing, right? It's like we've always been at war with East Asia. No, we've always been at war with Eurasia. And so is when you decided to call it the Orwellian Empire, was it mainly because of the continual wars, or do you see many other parallels?
Oh, no, it's not the continual war. It's the culture of lie. It's the culture of pretending that a war is peace. George Orwell was almost accurate on even on the date. On 1984, except, well, I would say that it's kind of started in 1980 and then became full-blown in 1989 at the fall of the Soviet Union. You see, that is the problem. Geopolitics, decent geopolitics, has to do with balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cold War, the old Cold War that you knew and I knew because we're actually exactly the same age,
mm-hmm.
It gave a balance to the world. Of course, there were flashpoints like Cuba crisis, like Vietnam, but it wasn't the same. I wrote recently an article that most people, they didn't get my point. It was an article to sort of plead for the reinstatement of the draft, okay? And in my opinion, and I don't. I can argue the opinion quite well. The reason why the U.S. got out of Vietnam, well, they were beaten by the Vietnamese, but that's not the reason. The reason was the draft. The reason was that there were no position in Americas against the war. But now the problem is the war has become a business fought by mercenaries, more or less, either real mercenaries or people that join the military because they don't have much more options in terms of work, in terms of employment. Okay, so it's just a question of when war has become so profitable, it is kind of tricky. And it's not only the U.S. France sell a lot of military gear. So does Russia. So does Germany. So does the U.K. It is big business, and that is the problem. We are all. Everybody has a lot of anxiety, and there's been a lot of noise on the web, even from serious people, of mentioning the notion of World War III. Well, we cannot let that happen. What we have to do, we have to focus on real issues, such as climate change, the state of security that was decreed by President Hollande in France is an absolute nightmare. I mean, I saw overnight, within 3 hours, my country, based on the principle of the French Republic of liberté, égalité, fraternité, turn into a police state. And this is not acceptable. See, people do not learn, unfortunately. France didn't learn about the Patriot Act here in the U.S. They didn't learn that increasing the security apparatus everywhere doesn't give anything in return. I mean, the empire, the Orwellian empire, with his nervous system in the U.S. is fighting a conceptual war, a war on terror, which doesn't mean anything. It is a conceptual war. You don't define the enemy. The enemy is diffuse. It has no end, and it's a notion of you fighting fear. Well, you don't fight fear by putting yourself in jail in the police apparatus. You just don't do that.
So is the propaganda aspect of the Orwellian Empire something that you focus on that's so important?
Absolutely. The propaganda is, well, you can find that, of course, in almost all U.S. mainstream media. Sometimes there's a little glitch, there's a little exception, but they corporate own. They need to, if you are, for example, if you are critical of Israel, of Israeli government on CNN, and speak up about it, you lose your job. People would rather, you know, maintain their job. If the same apply to NPR. You know, NPR invite people such as Henry Kissinger, who's been in the background of U.S. policymakers since Richard Nixon, to promote his book. Kissinger still has a lot of access in Washington and advise people. He's in his 90s and not presumably on top of his game, and sort of living in a mental construct of, if you wish, of the Cold War, the first one, let's say in the 50s. It's the same for the Clinton advisor, which, you know, Brzezinski, it's his name, and he's also a very, very old man. And unfortunately, those people are considered to be the wise man of U.S. foreign policy, and they are not. Okay, so it's sort of like it's time for a reality check, you know. And you're perfectly right. The Obama administration has not changed anything in terms of any aspect, really. From the Bush administration. No change. Just the rhetoric. Just the lie. You know, because at least the W didn't lie as much. You know, they didn't mind, you know, the Dick Cheney and so on. They were just the ugly Americans. They were not the some sort of humanitarian imperialist like Mr. Obama, for example.
We'll talk about that Orwellian term of humanitarian intervention.
Right. Well, the thing is, it's a mixture, if you wish, of the sort of bizarre reality world we live in is sort of between Orwell and Kafka, really, because you never know. You never know what's really going on. You have to sort of, when you people like you and I, which are, you know, try to make sense out of it for other people, you have to shift through so much disinformation. And the thing is, what is this beautiful thing that is the internet and the information superhighway, as in a sense improve things, but in other way, because it's now controlled by corporate interest, making it easier to diffuse various propagandas.
Well, yes, thank goodness for books like Orwellian Empire and your website. Talk a little bit about your website.
Well, my website was started in 2009, but it's always been a fairly ambitious project. It's we own the site. My partner, co-editor in chief, Daddy Chéri, who was born in Haiti, and as a matter of fact, we published a book not that long ago. It's called We Have Dared to Be Free, and it's about Haiti. And the angle of the site is very simple. It is to give people voices. We have people from India that write for the site. We have people from Turkey. We have people from the UK. We have people from all over the world. To give those people a voice, they all write English. That's the rule. We publish only in English. But to give them a voice so we can actually, American readers, European readers, Canadian readers, can learn things from the people's perspective, and not from what my colleague Daddy Chéri called the colonialists of the mind, which is I used to write about Haiti before she came in the site, and I've stopped because this is none of my business to write about Haiti. I write about geopolitics, world geopolitics, France. I write about the Middle East, about the stuff that I really know. It is something that is it's very difficult to maintain. You know, people do it pro bono. We're not paying anybody. We've never paid a dime to anyone. We maintain ourselves as best as we can. But it's always a struggle because it's hard to compete with the side that are well funded or do fundraisers or you know. I have nothing against doing fundraisers. We've never done it. It's not something that we do. But we have a lot of fans. You know, my article get republished. You know, pretty much on a regular basis in a site that we really like and support, which is Counterpunch. You know, I mean, there's a few people out there that are trying to keep American citizens informed about what's really going on, what the big media doesn't tell them in their one-liner and sort of snippet and distortion of things and the coverage of just like one big event at a time. You know, without giving any sort of in-depth analysis to anything. What we do on News Junkie Post, our mission, is really in-depth analysis and sort of like counter-programming, if you wish. Can you hear me, Cindy?
Hello, Stuber. I'm sorry, I'm having a little bit of technical problems today, but I got all of that. So it's newsjunkiepost.com.
That's it.
And unfortunately, we've run out of time. So tell my listeners how they can get more information about Orwellian Empire, which is available at Amazon.
Both of our book, published by our little, you know, book division, which is called News Junkie Post Press, Available on Amazon. Daddy Sherry's book on Haiti is called We Have Dared to Be Free. It's available both on paperback and Kindle. Mine is only available on paperback because I'm sort of a dinosaur, and I didn't want to make it on available on Kindle because to me a book is kind of an object, and it's something that you can carry around without internet connection or Wi-Fi or any of that. So I'm sort of an old fashioned person, I guess, it's the thing is what matter to us. What matter to us is that people read the book, not just, you know, consume the book. Today is Black Friday, and I encourage everybody to boycott this miserable early day of consumption. That is really part of the problem. So of course, you know, a book is a product. It has a tag price and a price, and Amazon is what it is. But I really highly recommend to your listeners to check out News Junkie Post and our book, both available on Amazon.com.
Well, when I post this show, I will definitely post links to your book and your website. And I just like my guests to say it in case people come to the show outside of my newsletter or my own website, right? So, Gilbert, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I hope you have a nice rest of your weekend. And I'll send you the show to share around when it's available on Sunday.
Cindy, it was a great pleasure. We can do it anytime.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Okay, bye-bye. Dylan Avery, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Cindy Sheehan, good to be back.
So I understand from your partner and friend and colleague, Corey Rowe, that you have a new edition of Loose Change coming out. And I think most of my listeners will be very familiar with that documentary, your film that's gone through various iterations. But what's new about the new version of Loose Change?
Well, I guess to be upfront about it, it's basically a HD version of American Coup, the last edition that we did back in 2009, cut down to 52 minutes for television airing. And essentially what happened with that is the original release in 2009 was held by Microcinema, the distributor. You know, we were on Netflix for a long time. Mm-hmm. It was going well. But then they basically closed their doors and filed for bankruptcy, and we were left without a distributor. So essentially we had this new – it wasn't even really a new HD version, because back in 2011, HDNet aired an HD version that we had kind of whipped up real quick for them. But we kind of had most of that work already done, and it was just sitting around. And with this being 2015, the 10-year anniversary of the first and second editions of Loose Change, first edition April 2005, and then second edition December 2005, shortly after meeting you in upstate New York.
Right.
So 10 years later, you know, we found that there was some renewed interest, and actually it came from our old international distribution company, Mercury Media, that worked with us for Loose Change Final Cut. Tim Spark, actually, his main contact, his company got acquired by Journeyman, which is a pretty big deal internationally, I guess. And they basically just started hitting up all the old properties and were just like, hey, you know, we've done this. We bought Mercury Media, and we're just kind of reaching out to people to see what is going on with all your films. So we were like, well, we've got this HD edition of the film that we were trying to give to our last distributor to get, you know, because we only had this old SD version of it. And it also had the mistake in the end with Smedley Butler, made the mistake of saying he was Army and he was a Marine. And that's actually one of the good things, is that this new cut of this edition of Loose Change has a different ending that instead of going into Smedley Butler, which was kind of a nice point and it made sense at the time, we never had the opportunity to re-record anything with Daniel Sanjata. So basically, I cut together a different ending with Stephen Jones and the late Jeanette McKinley to kind of bring her back and give her some final say in the film. So it's got a different ending. It's gotten, we've replaced that, the Smedley Butler thing with something that's a little bit more, I guess, related directly to 9/11 as opposed to doing another history lesson. And then I think there's some new, a bunch of new shots, basically replaced a bunch of footage with footage that I got from the NIST release, thanks to James Gourley at the International Center for 9/11 Studies. There's like a little segment that we replaced a bunch of computer graphics with real footage. And that's really kind of the fascinating thing for me. I'm not, maybe fascinating isn't the right word. but, you know, whenever you see these things, whenever you saw them, and usually even to date when you see them, it's always, you know, drawn out and it's got score voiceover. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, it's usually overproduced. But I mean, for me to like to just watch this raw footage and to listen to the sound, it's really incredible. So there's a new scene that basically replaced a bunch of computer graphics and sound effects with real footage. And there was a second one that I made for the collapses that I think didn't make it into the TV cut. But if we do release like the full extended film, because, you know, 52 minutes, again, is, I guess, for some people, the perfect runtime. But for other people, I would imagine they might want to see the fuller thing. But essentially, it's an HD shorter version of American Coup. That was the long version of the short answer, essentially.
Well, I'm glad that there's one criticism I had about Loose Change was I thought it was too many computer graphics and images. I thought that I'm excited about seeing the new one to see the actual footage of these things. I think it will make it more powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why do you think it's relevant for people to watch? Why is Loose Change still relevant today in 2015? 10 years, you know, after it was really a groundbreaking film. It wasn't perfect, you know, and that's why you guys worked on it so much. But in 2005, it really was a groundbreaking film.
No, I'm glad you asked that, actually. The reason it's still relevant is because there are people that are alive right now that weren't alive when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And it's
very young
enough for it to not have made an impression and not to have been such a catalyzing world event that it was for us. So there's a lot of versions of 9/11 out there, and there's a lot of it's actually would be interesting to see what a current history book looks like and what its thoughts on 9/11 are. But, you know, we've always tried to serve as kind of an alternate history book, which is one of the reasons there were so many additions to the film in the first place, is that we always viewed it as a historical document. Always striving to make it as accurate as possible. And again, first edition and even the second edition weren't really intended to be seen by millions of people and translated to pretty much every language known to man, which is one thing that at the time I think people kind of lost sight of. But in hindsight, I think hindsight's been a little bit more kind to us, where it's like, dude, I mean, you guys were how young when you made that film? It's been very interesting to see the journey and to look back on it. And even because I went back for April 13th of this year for the first edition, we posted the second edition's opening credits. I just kind of brought that one up to HD as I could. And then we posted that on our Facebook and on our YouTube. But it's interesting looking back at like the exact sequences that I edited 10 years ago and looking at what I'm working on now with Black and Blue. It's the timing has been really interesting converging between those two projects and a lot of similar things that happened in the lead up to both. So it's been very interesting. 10 years later, I'm making a much different film, but it's very similar in a lot of ways that I think people will recognize without it being just Loose Change with footage of cops, because it's quite the opposite of that.
Well, of course, the whole 9/11 incident really, I think it was like the resurgence of the police state, and, you know, many police forces look like they're paramilitary, you know, forces now. So I can see how there would be a lot of convergence between, and you were on the show recently to talk about Black and Blue. So I'll repost that to remind my listeners about it.
Yeah. My last appearance on your show was actually in the midst of my cross-country bus and rideshare trip across the country and back, which I will never do again. Definitely some interesting memories and, you know, some good life experience. But I guess the interesting nature about that trip and documentary filmmaking in general is that was back in, I believe, June 2014. And that was before Ferguson happened. And on my way back from that trip, I was playing phone tag with ex-LAPD officer Alex Salazar, mm-hmm. Who wound up becoming a very big centerpiece of the film. So I'm on this, you know, bus trip on the way back from shooting a bunch of interviews. I still wasn't entirely sure what kind of film I was going to wind up making. So still quite in the exploratory phase. So it is kind of interesting to circle back with you a year and a half later when I'm just about wrapping things up. And I've wound up with, I think, a much different film now than I thought I was making back then.
Okay, awesome. And like I said, I'll repost that show so my listeners can reacquaint themselves. So how can my listeners get their hands on this new HD version of one of the versions of Loose Change?
Lately I've been joking with Corey. It's the Street Fighter of conspiracy films, because, you know, Street Fighter 2, you know, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo Edition. So it's like Super Loose Change 4 Turbo Edition HD. I don't know. It's just there's just always a renewed interest. I mean, it's really what it comes down to. I mean, if there hadn't been the interest in the response to the first edition, there wouldn't have been a second edition. If the second edition hadn't been called the first internet blockbuster by Vanity Fair and all these microscopes started hovering on top of the film, that we wouldn't have pretty much felt obligated to make a third film, A, to follow up on it, and B, to correct what people might have thought have been wrong with the second one. And then with the third one and everything going south with Hollywood and Charlie Sheen and all that fun stuff, you know, we had an opportunity to make a final film, because we opened a communication with Daniel Sinjata and he was like, if you guys need a narrator for a new film, let me know. So it's like, okay, well, I guess we got to make a new film now. Mm-hmm. But it's always just been that kind of process of thinking that we're done and that people don't care about the film anymore. And then something happens where we get an email out of nowhere by a company that bought our old company and wants a 52-minute TV cut. And now, so on December 15th, it goes live on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. And then I would imagine if that does relatively well, that they'll try to push it back onto Netflix, because that was the big thing we were trying to do with Micro Cinema, is get that new HD cut up onto Netflix and to keep it going. But all things work out for a reason, and if this first digital on demand, I don't know if digital on demand, but basically the first digital push, if this goes well, I would imagine they'll push it onto Netflix after that.
Okay, great, Dylan. Sounds like things are really popping for you guys. I wish that these things weren't necessary. I wish that we weren't apparently in World War III or whatever World War number you want to call it right now.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it's just extreme. Everything that's happening is so extreme. So we need as many opportunities to educate ourselves and motivate ourselves to really get back in the streets and to try and end this evil empire and their wars.
Well, if I don't know how much time I have left, but just to comment on that, I mean, mm-hmm. I think if nothing else, it speaks to what the people in Ferguson, Baltimore did, because, you know, criticize the small minority of troublemakers for what they might have done. But the fact of the matter is, it's because of those people hitting the streets and the calm, collected, rational civilians of Ferguson hitting the streets for 100 days consecutively. Because of that, we started to see more and more accountability, to the point where now officers are almost fired the next day. In Spring Valley, that incident with the student is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Where the video went viral, and then the next day the guy was out of a job. So just to reflect the truth of what you said about getting back into the streets, you know, I think that, I think it can affect change.
Well, you know, thank goodness for troublemakers. And so I think people always tell me, well, what about the troublemakers? And I think the troublemakers are those that are the imperialists, the violent people, the so-called leaders. You know, those people they're the violent ones. And are we just supposed to lay around taking it and not getting in the streets and not stirring up some trouble, you know? So I say, you know, I say thank goodness for those people, because then that's when change really happens. So Dylan Avery, thank you so much for being on the show today, and we'll get you the show. We'll get you and Corey and the show, and you guys can pass it around, and we'll try to get 2016. I say this every year, 2000, you know, every year I'm like, this will be different. This year will be different. The people get fed up. The people take to the streets, and it's good. It's good that the Black Lives Matter movement and those movements are being so effective, but you know, we really need to care about people that are being killed outside of our borders too.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So thank you, Dylan, and I'm sure we'll be in contact.
Cool. Yeah, sounds good.
Have a good weekend.
You too, Cindy.
Well, that's the soapbox for this week. I hope you will check out all of the intriguing information that Gilbert and Dylan and I talked about this week. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Gilbert Mercier and Dylan Avery for their work and for their time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.